You're listening to Panel Borders, which is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comic books. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode I'm talking to Ollie Smith and Sean Azapardi, a couple of small press artists who self-publish diary drawing and autobiographical comics, which they sell at conventions and at the London Underground Comic Stall in Camden Market every Saturday. As this is my second interview with Ollie, following a more general one about the stall back in January, we started off talking shop about his business acumen. I'm talking to Ollie Smith from London Underground Comics. We're at the Bristol International Expo, and it's the second day of trading. And you've made £127 profit so far in one day?
Yes, exactly. How awesome is that? £127. What do you want me to say about £127?
How does that compare to a normal Saturday trading in Camden?
It's about 30% more. It depends on the day in Camden. Camden usually takes about £50-60. On a good day, it takes about 100. So it's surprisingly comparable, actually. Just kind of reinforces the idea that you don't have to be pitching at converted comics fans to be able to sell comics.
Since I interviewed you last, there's been increasing amounts of media attention directed at London Underground Comics. You've been on Radio 4 and had a film crew following you about for the last week or so.
I think it's just the fact that well, it was always something a bit different, something that hadn't really been no one had really thought to try before. It's a fairly simple thing to do, but I think it takes a bit of dedication to kind of invest the time, and we haven't got any competition, and it is making a difference, and it's an untapped market. I mean, I've said all this before, but it's just the fact that it's working, and the fact that it's still working and just getting better is probably the most encouraging thing. I mean, the word's kind of got around, it's got more popular. I mean, when we started, we started with 7-10 people, but now we've got about 30 people's different comics on the stall on a weekly basis.
It's funny, you're running the table here, and you run the table in Camden, and obviously you make similar amounts of money, but there's only 3 or 4 of these conventions a year. I suppose there are more small press ones as well. But the kind of people who are doing the same thing as you at conventions, I just don't understand why they're not doing the same sort of thing as you're doing in Camden. Why not, you know, get in touch with their local craft market and sell comics, you know, because you've proved that you can do this sort of thing in a different market.
Well, that's what I've been saying. I mean, the reason I started doing it was because it was just incredibly accessible for me living across the road from Camden Market. It just seemed like an obvious choice. Although I had been thinking of something like Spitalfields beforehand when I wasn't living in Camden. Yeah, it seems like the next logical step. But then there are a lot of people who kind of regard small press not as an entity in itself, but as more of a means to an end. They'll come to these conventions in the hope that they will show their comic to someone a bit kind of high-powered who might give them a job, and that's fine, but I never really understood why, in the meantime, they didn't want to make a bit of money. At the end of the day, they don't lose too much at these conventions, but, you know, it will pay for itself. They just get smaller print runs.
You've got a new comic out, Weekend Friends. What's the print run of the first issue?
I always get a print run of 100 initially, although these days, I mean, I personally shift about 20 comics a week, so they run out a lot faster. I mean, it's noticeable. It's a good feeling when you walk home at the end of the day with a box that's half empty, and you can feel the difference in weight, and that makes a big difference. And the fact is that, you know, when you've got a convention that's on 4 times a year, and you go from having this box in the corner of your room gathering dust that only gets opened the week before the convention, and will take you, you know, a year to shift those, is decreasing. It's half empty after a week. 2 weeks. I mean, my printers are happy because obviously they get more work.
It's a week in the life of Ollie Smith. If you want to sell Weekend Friends to people who don't know your work, I mean, how would you pitch it?
I'd pitch it as a journal. Basically, what I did was it's essentially a diary written the night of that day. I do 1 or 2 pages of the key scenes that kind of stood out on that day with the conversation, well, kind of a vague outline of what I was on and probably the most interesting thing that was said that day or something like that. I tried a kind of new cartoony style to kind of simplify it. It's a lighter comic than anything else I've had, because everything else is all about kind of very important points in my life, and I was just seeing whether the everyday could be taken pretty much literally.
And the text that you've added to this, I mean, it's the juxtaposition between a printed page, you know, with a simpler amount of detail, and then your handwritten text underneath the drawings, which are in a kind of a less polished style than you might have done in your other comics, because presumably you want it to have the nature of a diary entry that isn't sort of spell checked or copy edited.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I did the pages with the basically it's a page with a date, and it says in which our hero does this, which I actually nicked from Winnie the Pooh, because when I used to read Winnie the Pooh, I thought I had this kind of cartoony art style. A lot of people have kind of compared the art in Hazy Thursday actually to the artist for Winnie the Pooh, who I cannot remember the name of. And so I nicked that because I liked it. I mean, they always kind of give you a little thing of, this is what happens today, now enjoy the how it gets to that point. So I always quite like that. Also, it was padding because the comic was underrunning.
I spoke to you earlier about autobiographical comics, and you said there's something of the nature of the confessional. I mean, obviously, you've got friends who you, like, you know, share your life with. So what is it that you get out of complete strangers reading a slice of Ollie Smith's life?
I think what it is I think, like everybody, there's things you do where you kind of wish you hadn't quite said exactly that, or you put something different, and sometimes you made some ludicrous mistake, or sometimes you know, something funny's happened. It's self-deprecation, and that's what people like to see. People like to see people fall over at the end of the day. And so the idea was to kind of admit to my mistakes and acknowledge that I was making them, and by giving that out to complete strangers, that was my kind of way of saying, this is, it's, you know, I wouldn't go around to the people I know and go, you know, that thing I said 3 days ago, I didn't actually mean that, I meant something else, that kind of thing. It kind of, the idea is to get across the little small things that wouldn't really come up in conversation, but that you want to kind of apologise for, or say, that was really nice, but I never got around to telling you. And I think the reader, what I always thought about autobiographical comics was with the bond with the reader, in that I do this confession to the reader, but because of that, the reader gets this kind of gets to feel, in inverted commas, normal, in that they get to compare the minutiae of their life to that of someone else in a way that wouldn't be talked about around in the pub. You talk about your sex life or I don't know. I mean, in Dave Eggers' heartbreaking work of Staggering Genius, which is a very influential book for me, he says, If I told you how many times a day I masturbated, would it make any difference to your opinion to me? Because at the end of the day, I told you freely, and you would want that. You'd want that knowledge, because at the end of the day, it would help you feel normal if you compared it to how many times you masturbated a day, in a way that, you know, you never talk about that with your mates. You wouldn't really mention that. It's not something you'd sit around and talk about. But, you know, there's a little bond there that you kind of give with the reader in talking about the deeply personal. And I think a lot of autobiographical comics don't realise that that's the key selling point, and it's more of a, this is my cool indie lifestyle kind of thing. Kind of, it's more of a showing off, whereas mine is more of a, yeah, self-deprecation.
In a completely different tact, you've just written a comic called Block, which is being illustrated by Oliver Lambden from Tales of the Flat.
A day in the life of a stone statue that comes to life. Basically, I got bored of... I thought I was getting myself into a bit of a rut with autobiographical comics. As much as I enjoyed doing them, people were going, Ollie Smith, he's a good writer, but can he draw anything but... write anything other than autobiography. So I came out with this little kind of fairy story after a holiday on the Isle of Wight, where I just love the views of the white cliffs all over the place, and these kind of rolling green moors, and I wanted to write some kind of fairy story. I had this image. And so, so I came out with this nice little short story. I think it's the best thing I've ever written. It's really simple, really clean kind of style to it. And I think that's why I gave it to Oliver, because Oliver's art is a lot cleaner, more kind of polished, but still has that kind of atmosphere that I wanted. I was trying to move out, and I'm very proud of it. You know, it's not out yet, but I think when it will be, I mean, it's been through a lot of illustrators, but when it is out, I will be one of the best things I've written.
And you're launching it at the comics convention that you've curated on the 31st of this month in Camden. So you've taken your Camden stall and actually expanded it into a larger area of the market, but also marked it as a comics convention in its own right.
Yes, basically, in terms of trying to compete with conventions in popularity, the great thing about the store was the consistent sales and the making of money and the fact that it was all profit.
People aren't going to Camden Market to buy comics. They're going there to buy fashionable things, and they come across your comic store.
That too, the untapped market and taking advantage of that. What we didn't have that conventions do have is this excuse for everybody, all your mates and stuff in comics, to come down on one day and you all get to see everybody. And that's something that I was really keen on. I mean, obviously, there's 10 people usually a week on the stall, or they'll pop by for the afternoon or whatever. And so you get to see them that way. But in terms of the actual scale, we needed to have an event. I mean, the event's not spectacularly ambitious, but the point is more to bring everybody down and kind of show it how it works, maybe inspire them to try something of their own, but also to get to see everybody and without having to spend lots of money going to a convention and paying table rent. And so we get to kind of try and sell comics to the outside world, because conventions usually are quite out of the way. They're quite out of the way, and they have high admissions prices, so you don't get the regular guy off the street, whereas No Barcodes is set in the heart of Camden Market with people walking past all the time, and so you get the cosy family atmosphere of the fact that we're all sitting in one kind of hall or in the pub outside having a drink with each other. But then you've also got the added bonus, really, of selling comics to people who aren't interested. And also, having an event in the market would be more likely to draw the casual passerby than just having a stall, because they'd be more interested to see, oh, what's going on here, kind of thing. Whereas if they just walk past another novelty stall, they wouldn't necessarily stop. So we should hopefully bring in more punters because of that.
And also, you're less likely to scare away the average Joe on the street, because there won't be a phalanx of stormtroopers wandering up and down the convention. Although there might be the odd cosplayer, but that's just because what people wear in Camden on the best of days.
Exactly. I think cosplay probably fits into Camden more than at a convention, considering some of the gear these goths wear these days. But yes, we're definitely not taking any mainstream comics. That's not the point. It's a celebration of what's in Britain at the moment, and what's, you know, the British talent is not in the mainstream. British talent is in the underground, and just, people just need to see. And when they do see, they enjoy it and they appreciate it. And we have people who've been regular customers at the stall coming to the convention having made a comic specifically so they can take part, because they've discovered this world through this comic stall that they actually really enjoy and they didn't know was there. And they thought that, you know, if they were making a comic, then they had to find a publisher and have this absolutely fantastic, clean Steve Ditko art style.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm talking to Sean Azapardi. Apparently you've already made about 20 quid in the last day.
Yeah, that's a real surprise to me. I'm just ecstatic now I can retire. It's just brilliant. I actually haven't asked him what I've sold, so I don't want to ask him. I'll just be surprised at some point.
I mean, you've actually got a graphic novel on the stall, 12-hour shift. Do you find that that sells in greater numbers, or at least in terms of profit per issue, the amount that you sell on a regular basis is more economical than selling individual issues?
Yeah, it's something I've had to sort of have a look at recently. I would say it seems to sell slow but steady, I think. But if I collect all the 6 issues that's in there and put them together, I think overall, yeah, it's a better format to sell it, but it's just slower and steadier. So, but it's still a novel experience for me because I've only had it for a few months. So I'm still taking it in as to whether it's a better viable option, really. I mean, on the table there's kind of single issues and people come up and look at them and they are immediately attracted to them, and obviously they're £1, £2, and I would be the same. I'd go up to the table and I'll see a book and think, maybe I'll check it out later. Whereas I'll see a single issue and I'll be grabby, I've got to have that. So, yeah, I think it's a long-term goal, sales-wise.
You've given up having a regular job now to just concentrate on comics, while your graphic novel is actually a chronicle of working in a soulless job that you hated. How do you find the transition?
Absolutely fantastic. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time but not been in the position of doing. Now that I am, okay, I've lost a prime source material for making comics. It's just brilliant. Of course, I might not be saying that in a few months when I'm completely penniless and out begging for change, but at the moment it gives me a massive amount of creative time. And I guess it would be very easy to just sit playing computer games all day and drinking myself into the small hours of the morning. But I've found that I've filled the time out productively and just being able to sit down and do things other than just the core drawing. I can actually sit down and write scripts and flesh a lot of other things out that I just naturally wouldn't have the time for. I just am very excited by it. I think is the way to talk about it. And also I can get a lot of time to sit in this garden and get some sun.
When it came to making 12-hour shift, were you actually drawing some of those pages while you were at work, or was that too much for a risk?
No, all the time. I mean, it was over 3 years, so that took in, I think, two major jobs at the time. The actual book is written mostly about one place I worked in, and then I drew most of it when I was working in another place. And that place, they were quite happy for you to draw at the desk, read, write. And, yeah, I did do a lot of it there. And the residents become very interested because they were obviously very vain about it and saying, oh, are we going to be in this book? And I said, no, it's not about this place, sorry. And they looked slightly wounded by that. But I thought, well, if you actually read it, you'd probably be quite happy that you're not in here. So, whereas the actual names of the people in the book weren't changed from the place that I worked in, so hopefully they will never read it. But they were fairly old, so they may not be around now to actually read it.
Had you made many comics before then, or was it the job that kind of inspired you to sort of record your life in comic format?
I'd got like what I'd probably loosely term a horror anthology called Grey Sky, which was actually just my first mini comic self-published thing. And we're here at Bristol now, and my first one I brought here in a carrier bag in 2002 and was handing it out, which it was also, I'd photocopied on the works photocopier, that type of thing. So I think up to then, I'd done them for about 3 years, but it was just kind of like the misery of trying to have a job and do comics that did inspire that. So.
And after handing out the horror comic, did you get feedback from your peers and encouragement to keep making the mini comics?
No, not really. No, no. I was actually surprised because at the time I was part of a group of people that met on a Thursday for Comic Day, but also were a bunch of writer artists which I'd hooked up with, and since gone on to the industry. Like Anthony Johnston was one of them. Roger Mason, Andrew Wheeler, who was a journalist in comics but is now a food journalist. So I'd got a peer group that were a good sort of base for criticism, really. So I was pleasantly surprised when they did actually like it, because the things that I used to do before, the stories in Grey Sky were a lot more miserable than my 12-hour shift thing. So I seem to specialise in miserable stuff for a long while.
But having given up a regular job, does that mean you're going to have a sunnier outlook now when it comes to making comics?
Oh, absolutely. I think sunny is the way forward. Sunny is the new miserable, I think, definitely. Obviously, you go through stages when you're creating stuff and events that happen in your life. And sometimes it's actually at the moment when you're making stuff. But also, it's a retrospective look at things. And, yeah, I've got a sunny disposition and I would hope to reflect that in some new work, although it's a weird experience.
So you've just started collaborating with Daniel Merlin Goodbury on a new horror-stroke-action comic called Necessary Monsters, which involves beheadings and people being punched through the stomach. How does the sunny disposition work with that?
Yeah, I just thought about that when you said that. I approach it with a sort of more positive frame of mind, I guess. Yes, I don't know. Maybe it gets cheerful later on, I don't know.
How did the collaboration come about? Because Daniel's got a very kind of different style to yours. He uses these kind of doctored, computer-generated images. Was it because when he wanted to tell a sort of horror-stroke-action comic, he wanted something a bit grittier and your style suited that?
I think there may be a bit in that, and he may have remembered sort of the horror strips that I did from Grey Sky and things like that. But also, as you probably know with this scene, there's a lot of sort of cross-pollination with people, even if it's just conversation. And I've known Daniel for a while, but never really spoke to him in any great depth. And just at, I think it was The Thing last year, I'd got a table next to him, And I just said to him, we should do something sometime. So he said, I'll write something down that you like. And I wrote a list of stuff, and he said, no, that's rubbish. I'll come up with something else. And it just started from there. I think these things always start really with a conversation. And you realise that it's somebody that you'd like to do something with.
What's it like collaborating with a writer when you're used to writing and drawing your own stuff?
I do enjoy it, actually. It's I was talking last night to a lot of people about this, because there's a few people going through the process of their own self-publishing to working with writers. And this, I think the simple thing is, it just shoves you out of your comfort zone, to use a cliched saying. Despite what anybody says, if they write and draw their own stuff, they like writing and drawing stuff that they can manage, and it's not difficult. Although we say otherwise, that immediately you just got to draw things that you wouldn't draw, and in a way that you wouldn't draw them as well. Maybe stick legs on them or something. So once you're actually prepared to do that, you can. It's invigorating to be pushed out of the comfort zone. Yeah.
So does he give you art direction as well as just a script?
No, his script's quite loose, but all the relative information there. He wouldn't sort of say this character's got 6 buttons on their coat or something like that. It just describes what's there, gives you the text. And after that, once you've actually made the page, sent them off to him, it might be, oh, I'd like this change and that change, and then you kind of work your way around that. Obviously, if I was a brilliant artist, I'd hit it off straight away, and he wouldn't need to say anything like that. Because I'm working digitally, there's kind of a bit of after sort of manipulation, which, so you can change things, so there's a bit of looseness there.
When it came to the visual references for the art, there's all sorts of different things you've got at play there, sort of Japanese horror movies, these sort of American black ops thrillers. Is that something that you've been interested in culturally, or something that kind of Daniel brought to you for the first time?
No, I kind of like do read and watch a lot of trash. Sorry, cultural genius. And so that was another thing that I was happy to collaborate with, because those kind of things that I've probably watched over the years but would never put in my work, you suddenly go back and reference them and think, all right, yeah, I used to be into this type of thing, and why did I never do anything with it? So I'm kind of enjoying that. There's like a character in there that you can only see mainly her teeth and her nose, and it's like a ring character, and that was a film I really enjoyed when I went to the ICA and completely forgot about, so had to watch it again, so all those kind of things. So I'm really actually enjoying sort of boning up on stuff, really.
Well, I guess it means you're getting to make your own kind of Japanese horror movie.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's it. I'm going to get a few of my friends to star in it as well, maybe, at some point. Although we haven't got any kind of like large Godzilla creatures around, so...
How many issues is it going to run to?
Well, the thing is that the issue that we've got on the table now was going to be like an Ashcan, but it sort of came out a bit better than Ashcan. So that'll be kind of... I think we're just having that issue. Then it'll be going online and appearing twice a week, but also there'll be one day where we're going to have guest artists and writers who'll be doing like fanfic, I guess, and then at some point it'll get published. I mean, I don't know whether, we're not quite sure whether it'll be published while it's still online or not. It just depends on how quickly the work gets done, really. That's a bit loose at the moment.
Well, I mean, it's quite interesting that you started off in print and gone to a webcomic, because I was talking to Paul Duffield yesterday, who's actually making money from just doing a webcomic, but at the same time, he obviously finds it somewhat gratifying that he can come to a convention and do prints of his art that only actually exists digitally otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I think... I'm fascinated by the model of being online. I've had this conversation with Ollie a lot of times, and he's, like, dead against it, whereas I think, as both publicity... and as a working model, I think it is the way to go for a lot of people. And it's readily more acceptable with people now as well. But also, again, it shows the kind of flexibility of the medium that we're involved in, that it does just go over so many areas. But I can't see how comics would exist without the internet now, to be quite honest. Even down to just contacting, networking or anything. For instance, I wouldn't listen to your show, and I wouldn't know, I probably wouldn't know you and half the people here if it wasn't for the wonderful world of the internet. So, yeah, just embrace it all, really. Also, I wouldn't sit in front of my computer for like 12 hours thinking I'm doing some work, and in fact, I'm just surfing the net all day. But, yeah, it's a vital tool, really.
Actually, I mean, ditto, I wouldn't have heard of London Underground Comics if a friend of mine hadn't joined their Facebook group, you know. But looking at the print version of Necessary Monsters, how does that differ then from the online one? Because obviously, at its most basic, it's in the format of a traditional small press comic, which is to say it's taller than it is wide, while conversely, a computer screen is landscape format. So is it as simple as cutting each page in half, or do you have to recompose the narrative depending on which medium it's being viewed in?
I think it probably will be just single pages. It's going to be in Comic Press, which is just like an attachment to WordPress. And if anybody's seen Daniel's things, they're obviously strips or small kind of, well, strips or squares. They actually just work out the same thing. So a full page, I'm not really sure. I mean, it will be a full page. I'm not really sure how that's going to work. Because obviously the accepted format isn't a full page, really, because of just simple reading matters. So I'll be interested to see how that works out, actually. Again, I think it's a full page, though. I don't think we're dividing anything up. Although, when I've laid it out and drawn it, haven't done really any panels that burst out from the square format. So there may be a possibility of doing that. But I think it's just a page a day, twice a week.
Cool. And is it at Daniel's site? What's the URL? Actually, no, I noticed on the back you've got a new website just for the comic.
Yeah, we've actually set a space up for it, which is just necessarymonsters.com. There's a holding page and a little bit of information now there, and we're going to start uploading it probably soon. I mean, it's also got to talk to the publishers about it, just to let them know what's going on, which is AIT, Planet La are going to be publishing it. So once he's contacted Larry just to say this is it, then it'll start being updated on a regular basis. And then I've got to sort of like work really hard because it's going to be published twice a week. So that's probably when I'll have a complete breakdown and be like really miserable forever, and because I'll never get outside again.
And on that happy note, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
For more info about Ollie's comics, please visit www.idlechild.co.uk. And for more info about Sean's, please visit fatcats.org.uk. That's spelled P-H-A-T-C-A-T-Z. And for more info about the weekly stall in Camden, not to mention the No Barcodes One-Day Festival on the 31st of May, please visit www.londonundergroundcomics.com. On next week's Strip and Panel Borders, I'm talking to the creators of the new kids comic, the DFC, including writer Philip Pullman, who's swapping armoured polar bears for sailing ships, son and mother team John and Patrice Aggs, and artist Jim Medway. That's on air and online at the usual time next week. More info at www.panelborders.com. Thanks for listening.